The 1999 murder of Haman Lee in Baltimore, Maryland, and the prosecution and conviction of Adnan Syed and her murder has now been documented in multiple podcasts with dozens and dozens of episodes. It's been written about in hundreds of articles. It's been covered by every major news outlet and has launched a global movement for justice. And yet, there is much more to the story, including Adnan's own telling of it. St. Martin's Press brings you Adnan's Story, Murder, Justice, and the Case That Captivated a Nation, the first and seminal book about the case that I was honored to write with contributions from Adnan himself. The book releases September 6, 2016, but is already available for pre-order. Go to www.adnanstory.com to place your order and reserve your copy today. This week's episode is brought to you by Stamps.com. You know that feeling of getting things done with just the click of your mouse? It can't get much more convenient than that. Now you can get your mailing and shipping done without leaving your desk using Stamps.com. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your computer and printer. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code Undisclosed for this special offer. You get a four-week trial and $110 in bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Undisclosed. That's Stamps.com and enter Undisclosed. Hi and welcome to the first of a series of special Undisclosed episodes. My name is Rabia Chaudhry, but today you won't be hearing from me or Susan Simpson during this episode. Let me explain. As you all know, we've wrapped up coverage, barring future events, of Adnan's case, and we are neck deep in investigating a new murder mystery and wrongful conviction. Season 2 of Undisclosed with this new case will begin on July 11th in just a couple of months, and we'll be coming to you with an exciting new format. But we didn't want to leave our listeners hanging in the interim, and as we've explored in the past year, there are dozens of issues and thousands of stories in criminal justice that need closer examination. So for the next 2 months, we'll cover new issues and cases, including well-known cases like the one from the documentary Making a Murderer, and we're going to bring you interviews with fascinating people doing extraordinary work in the field of criminal justice, including an interview with Stephen Avery's attorney himself, Dean Strang. Colin, Susan, and I will be doing most of these episodes individually, but we'll come together a couple of times for some special ones. We began this series with an interview that I've really been looking forward to hearing, having heard the compelling and heartbreaking story of Justin Chapman, who was convicted of murdering his 79-year-old neighbor in 2006. This week, Colin Miller takes the helm. Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the editor of the Evidence Prof blog. In today's episode, Colin interviews Bill Rankin, a legal affairs writer at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and the host of the Breakdown podcast, which covered Chapman's case and other criminal justice issues. They talk about Bill's podcast, our podcast, and the death penalty.
So, Bill, this is your 27th year, I guess, at the AJC, and you began there 3 years after your father, Jim, had worked there for 26 years himself. Can you tell me a bit about your father as a person and a reporter?
Oh, sure. My dad passed away a number of years ago. He was an editor at the paper, largely. He was a city editor. He was a night city editor. One of my strongest memories of him are waking up in the morning, having to go to school and going to the bathroom to brush my teeth or get ready and looking through the door, and he was still sound asleep, and I was always so jealous. But he had been up till, you know, midnight or 1 o'clock, and he loved the newspaper business, and it certainly had a enormous influence on me. You know, I was thinking one of my strongest memories about him and being an editor at the paper was in 1968, I was 9 years old, and I woke up way early before my parents woke up, and he had been up, he had probably gotten to bed at midnight or 1 o'clock, and I went to go look at a cartoon, and there were no cartoons on because it was all the news coverage of Bobby Kennedy being shot, and I immediately ran to him in bed and woke him up, and I'll never forget the sigh that came out of his mouth. You know, he was just so heartbroken, and he immediately got up, put his clothes on, and went into work. So that's kind of the childhood I had. It was a lot of fun. We kept up with the news a lot.
And is that something where you felt that being in the newspaper business was in your blood and always something you wanted to do, or was it something that you decided upon a little bit later?
I think I decided, I always say I had ink in my blood because of my dad. I decided in college, I just decided maybe I wanted to be like him. And he told me to think twice about it. He said, you'll never make any money going into the newspaper business. And that was not too far off the mark. But I tell you, I have loved it. I have just been so lucky, especially covering courts and legal affairs. I've covered fascinating cases. I've met amazing people, judges and lawyers. And just being in a courtroom in dramatic moments, it's nothing like it.
And is that something that you consciously chose that you wanted to be a legal affairs reporter, or was that something that sort of stumbled into your lap?
When I first got here, I was in a bureau north of Atlanta in Gwinnett County, and I was thrown into being a police reporter. And I didn't really like it because I had a really hard time talking to people right after a loved one had just died. It was so difficult for me to encounter that kind of grief. Some people can do it, and I admire him for it. But through that, I got initiated into the court system. I went to University of Georgia, and I majored in political science, and I had a great political theory teacher. And the course he taught on Plato, The Search for Truth, really had a huge influence on me. And I think that's kind of what covering courts is. It's the search for truth. That had a huge influence on me, and I've gravitated to that. When there was an opening for a court reporter job, I put in for it immediately, and I've been covering them now for more than 25 years.
Yeah, it's interesting because my background isn't that different in the sense that I majored in political and social thought at the University of Virginia, and I remember reading Plato and the allegory of the cave and thinking about this search for truth, right?
Exactly.
And that's interesting because now if we shift gears, you've been this reporter at the AJC since 1989. Fast forward to last year, May 2015, and you started the Breakdown podcast. And when I first heard about this, I thought it was about Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. But then I had someone who told me, I know, actually, it's about this court case in Georgia, and it's about the breakdowns in the criminal justice system there in Georgia. So can you tell us a bit, for those who haven't heard the podcast, who are listeners of our podcast, about this Justin Chapman case?
Sure. Well, it's a story about a murder case out of West Georgia. It's a small town called Bremen, Georgia. It happened in 2006. Justin Chapman lived in a duplex with an elderly woman who lived next door. He'd had a terrible accident at work on his foot. He became addicted to pain pills, and he became addicted to meth after that. So he's not the most sympathetic character at the time, for sure. But one night, this drunken and angry man who lived down the street showed up at his door, and he was itching for a fight because he said Justin had called his aunt a redheaded crack whore. And he got on the phone and he called his brother, this guy, William Paul Chives, who showed up drunk at the door, called his brother and said, you know, we got to show these people what we do when they mess with us Chives. So that got Chapman really angry and he pistol whipped him. And the guy fell to the ground. He left. And after he left, essentially Chapman and his family were with two friends. They were worried about payback coming to the house, so they packed up their bedding and drove across town and spent the night at their friend's house. And just an hour or two later, the house burned to the ground, and the woman, 79-year-old woman, Alice Jackson, died in the flame. So Chapman was later charged with setting that fire and murder, and the motive was that his landlord had told him that she wanted him to move because there were too many people in such a small little duplex house. And they hadn't evicted him, but they told him they wanted him to move, so that was his revenge because of that, which has always struck me as very strange because it seems like he would move out first. If you really wanted to get revenge, you'd move all your stuff out and then burn the house down. But anyway, he was indicted, he was tried, and he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. I guess what we found was before the trial, during the trial, after the trial, throughout this whole case, just about every player involved in the justice system, you know, didn't do their job. And that's what really struck me. And it was just very sad what happened. And I think it's what your podcast is showing is, sadly, it's not terribly unusual.
Yeah, I can say here in South Carolina, at the time of recording this, we're recording this on April 6th, the Post and Courier, the paper out of Charleston, just did a report about the inadequacies of the public defender system in South Carolina and Charleston specifically. And there are really so many systematic problems that exist. And I guess the launching point for both our podcast, Undisclosed, and partially yours was the Serial podcast. And so can you tell me a bit about you being this newspaper reporter for all these years and then hearing Serial and what impact that had on the decision to start the Breakdown podcast?
Sure. Well, I love podcasts, and I go for a walk every morning, try to go for 3 to 5 mile walk before I start my day, clears my mind. But I'm also listening to podcasts, so I'd certainly been listening to Serial. My wife and I listened to it on a long drive. We kind of binged, listened through it, and I loved it. I've always loved Sarah Koenig and her work for This American Life. I guess what happened was that my managing editor went on Thanksgiving vacation, and he listened to it, and he came back to the newsroom and talked to my editor, Richard Hallex, who's the producer of Breakdown and fantastic editor, said, "Can we do anything like this?" Richard came to me, and there was this case that I'd already, I back up a little bit. One of Chapman's lawyers had called me one day about a few months before that and said, "You know, Bill, I think I'm representing an innocent man who's in prison for murder." That certainly caught my attention, and I respect this lawyer, so I went and talked to him, and he gave me every transcript there was of the trial, the habeas, and I read through hundreds of pages. So I felt like it, even at that point when Richard came to me and asked me, I had this case, and I was kind of chomping at the bit to write a series of stories about it. And I said, "Well, you know, I have this case here." He said, "Do you want to do it?" And I said, "Let's give it a try." Well, we didn't have any idea what we were getting into. I had done nothing like this before. It was a lot of fun. It was hard. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I guess following up on that, at the time you started this, you had 2.5 decades as a newspaper reporter, and speaking to those difficulties and I guess the different medium as well, what did you see as the differences in recording and putting together this podcast as opposed to more traditional newspaper reporting?
One thing that's similar, before getting to what's different, is that really you're just telling a story. You know, you're telling a story, and that's what I've been doing and what my editor Richard has been doing for decades. So in that sense, we're doing nothing different than what we've been doing. But I've never had to really think about audio sound. Never had to use it, really. So we hired a longtime public radio reporter, Susanna Capiluto, and she kept telling me, you know, you got to get sound, you got to get sound. So we did as much as we could. We interviewed as many people as we could. We had a very tough time getting the recordings of the habeas hearing and the trial from the court reporters because they're pretty protective of it. But eventually they came around, and that really helped us. I wish the quality was better. We've enhanced the quality a lot. If you listen, some of the tape from the trial and the habeas hearing is pretty rough. So I had to try to repeat what was being said. But I thought that really kind of drew people into the moment. I guess that was a big difference, really having to go find good audio. We found it had a great police interview of one of Justin Chapman's best friends. It's interesting.
Yeah, and speaking to that search that you did in this, looking through the documents and the audio and all that, your podcast premiered essentially soon after the Supreme Court of Georgia granted Justin a new trial based on a few Brady violations. Is there any update about the status of the case? Is there a new trial that's gearing up? Is there possible plea bargain, or do you know what's currently happening there?
There has been absolutely no change. The prosecution is deciding whether to retry him or not, and I expect we'll have a decision fairly soon. It's taken a long time. It's been months and months, but as you know very well, a lot of times in the justice system, things don't happen very quickly. Like in Chapman's case, the habeas transcript, it took more than a year to prepare, so that held his appeal up, you know, for a year before he could even get to the Georgia Supreme Court, when he was sitting in jail for that whole year while the transcript was being prepared.
Right, I guess that takes us to season two in the sense that, on the one hand, the Justin Chapman case is something where the wheels of justice are grinding slowly and it's uncertain what's going to happen, whereas, again, at the time of recording this, according to your podcast, we're less than a week out from jury selection in your second season case, and it's a very different case in the sense that, whereas likely almost no one listening to Breakdown had any familiarity with the Justin Chapman case, your second season case is the case of Justin Ross Harris, and that might not be a name that immediately sparks the light bulb for listeners, but it is a case that very much garnered a good deal of national attention. And can you fill us in, for those who might not remember the name, as to the overview of the Justin Ross Harris case?
Justin Ross Harris was a IT guy who worked at Home Depot. He was married and had a young son, Cooper, who was 22 months old. In June of 2014, it was his turn to drive Cooper to daycare. They stopped by a Chick-fil-A for breakfast. He strapped him in his car seat. And when he got in the car, he could either drive just a little ways and then turn left to daycare or go straight back to his work at Home Depot. Very close by. And instead of turning left to daycare, he drove straight to Home Depot and left Cooper in the car. He died, they think, probably 2 hours or so after he had been left in the car, where the heat in the car rose to 120 degrees. It was a hot June day in Atlanta. He's been charged with this murder. Prosecutors have said he intentionally left him in the car, and they are seeking malice murder conviction against him, as well as a negligence conviction, murder conviction. And I guess what drove this case into the stratosphere was that it came out that he was sexting with women, other women, not his wife, while Cooper was out in the car dying that day, and that he had been doing that for quite a while in the weeks and months leading up to what happened.
Right, and it's interesting because you've reported in this case, similar to your first season case, how the prosecution has shifted the motive and sort of changed the theory a bit. The difference being, as we noted a minute ago, in the Chapman case, you were reporting about something where the trial had occurred and it was the first episode right after the Supreme Court of Georgia had reversed the conviction, whereas this case, you are writing about the state's case and noting both strengths and weaknesses, etc., as this case is gearing up for trial. And so how do you feel? I mean, it's something we, on Undisclosed, have struggled with as well, reporting about a case before and even during reopened PCR proceedings. So what do you sort of see as your role, your responsibility, and your obligations as you're reporting on this case right before this trial is going to start?
Well, I feel like my responsibility is to be as fair as possible to both sides, always. I guess the thing about this trial is that there have been quite a few pretrial hearings, and there have been several motions hearings, suppression hearings. And I guess, as you know, during suppression hearings, a lot of the evidence that's going to be, the prosecutor's going to try to admit during at trial will come out during those hearings. So I think we've seen a lot of what's going to happen at the trial play out early already. So that's been very interesting. And I've gotten a lot of audio from, much better audio, by the way, of these pretrial hearings and all the news of the sexting and, you know, the defense has tried to keep it out. They've been unable to. So all this stuff about his prurient sex life have come out during these hearings. And it's been pretty rich, actually.
Yeah, in addition to that, in your second episode, what I found fascinating was at one of those hearings, defense counsel was interrogating the officer and pointed out that the officer hadn't looked into and wasn't aware that actually he's deaf in his right ear, which is hugely important to the facts of the case, right?
Right. Yeah, it was interesting the way he didn't want to answer the question. I think he said, are you aware if he has any physical limitation? And he said, well, if you have a physical limitation, you can't operate a motor vehicle. But then he said, well, are you aware that he was deaf in his right ear? And Cooper was right behind him to his right in the car seat, the rear-facing car seat. So if he had been making noise, it's likely that Harris would not have heard him.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because, and I've written about this in my blog, actually in my post today on April 6th, is really your second episode of the second season, which just premiered. You really lay out and say, here are five or six specific flaws in the state's case. And again, in the first episode, you laid out a lot of the incriminatory evidence that the state had, but you really almost like a lawyer sort of break it down and go through, and you even have your own drive test, like in Serial, where you're comparing your notes of that intersection where he had to choose whether to go to drop off his child or go to Home Depot. And I'm wondering, in that sense, you talk about Plato and seeking the truth and just seeing how you have approached these cases. Was it ever in your mind to become an attorney or be involved in the criminal justice system that way?
I felt like one. Sometimes. I've read so many briefs and so many court opinions. I've always wondered what it would have been like if I'd have chosen that route. I got to say, though, I'm not blowing smoke here. I absolutely love what I do, and I feel so lucky. I love covering the justice system. I really feel like it's my job to do whatever I can when I see inequalities to write about them and to expose them. I've really dedicated myself to doing that, not just writing about big decisions and big trials. I really try to do some investigative work and look at the big picture and I've met so many wonderful people along the way. So maybe I would have enjoyed being a lawyer. You know, it's funny, my dad always wanted to have been a lawyer, he said, but I think I'm happy with what I'm doing.
Yeah, and you talk about uncovering these injustices in the system, whether they are big or small or something that people might be aware of or not. One of the really interesting things that I saw you write about recently, this was last fall, and it was right about the time of the Richard Glossop case, that case of the man in Oklahoma who was going to be executed, but then there were issues with the lethal injection cocktail. Around that time, you had an article about the secrecy involved in George's death penalty, and can you tell me a bit about what that article was about?
Sure. I've written a lot about the death penalty over the years because it's interesting. You mentioned my dad. When I told my dad I was going to be covering courts, he told me, he said the state doesn't wield any more power than it does when it administers the death penalty. So make sure you cover it every step of the way. And I've always tried to do that, taking his advice. Georgia has a secrecy law that shields from public scrutiny just about everything that has to do with carrying out a death penalty. And the story I wrote basically said that the process is shrouded in secrecy and wrapped in contradiction. It's not easy to explain. In order to carry out an execution in Georgia, you use pentobarbital, which is a Schedule II drug. So in order to get that, you have to have a valid prescription. So you have to have a doctor write a prescription to a pharmacy to make the drug. Well, Colin, this is hard to explain. I can do better. But this, I struggled so hard with this story because it's so complicated.
Yeah. The first article I wrote at a law school was about the Supreme Court that had this opinion in Heckler versus Cheney. And it was about people trying to get the FDA to regulate the drugs used in lethal injection because the FDA, for instance, they regulate the drugs used to anesthetize animals when they're used by vets. And the FDA said, we don't want to get involved in this. We don't want to regulate the drugs. And it's a difficult subject, both scientifically, it's complicated, but also in terms of the efficacy of the drugs used. And I think, you know, the main point, the main takeaway from your article that I got was that this is something where there's a lack of transparency.
Right. Well, the state, you need to have a valid prescription. And so then if you were to try to get the doctor's name who's writing that prescription or the pharmacy name, the state believes that once those names become public, these people would be harassed and would no longer participate. So then they would have no way to get these drugs. And the reason they're having to do it this way anyway is because all the makers around the world and the country who make pentobarbital have said, no, you're not going to use it for execution. So they have to go to a compounding pharmacy to do it. So Georgia enacted a secrecy law that shields from view all the names of everyone involved, the pharmacy, the doctor. And what's kind of interesting is under the Controlled Substances Act, pentobarbital can only be obtained with a valid prescription. And Georgia law says a licensed physician can prescribe a controlled substance for a legitimate medical purpose and when the doctor is acting in the usual course of his professional practice. So when Georgia passed this secrecy law, they said when doctors who are participating in an execution, whether through prescriptions or a pharmacy, that is not a regular medical practice. They put that into the law to make that an exception. So I guess they're not violating the law, but you know, there's a Hippocratic Oath and the American Medical Association standards of ethics. They seem to be violating those. You know, the Hippocratic Oath goes back to the 5th century BC. It's the do no harm. Well, these prescriptions that are being written, we have had limited access through some litigation to get some of these documents. The actual prescription, they had the name of the patient, the birth date, social security number, the address on death row, and the prescription reads, administer as ordered per execution order. So it's really something. I mean, as a journalist, you don't like it when things are in the dark, especially involving a time when the state wields its most power. It's been frustrating for me, but I can understand why they're shielding it from view. If they, you know, I guess if they say if you can't have a death penalty, if you can't get the drug, so you got to shield doctors from public scrutiny, otherwise they'll never do it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in many senses, Georgia is the epicenter of the death penalty. And I'm not sure, growing up, your awareness, but 1972 was the Supreme Court's opinion in Furman versus Georgia, and that's when the moratorium was placed in the death penalty, because the quote by Justice Potter Stewart was that the death sentences were cruel and unusual in the same way that being struck by lightning is cruel and unusual. And you noted your memory before about the assassination of RFK. It was then a year later in 1973 that then Governor Jimmy Carter signed off on Georgia's new death penalty. It was upheld by the Supreme Court 4 years later in 1976. And then another thing I noted was a few years ago, you reported on now former President Jimmy Carter and sort of being the J. Robert Oppenheimer of the death penalty, noting how he does not stand by it anymore, how there are issues in terms of how it's applied, etc. So I guess, you know, growing up in Georgia and seeing this whole history of the death penalty, what have you taken away from seeing how it was administered and is administered in the state?
Well, like I said, I'd like to look at the broader picture, and I've really closely followed the death penalty. So a few years ago, one of my editors asked me what project would I like to do, and I said, well, you know, there's one thing that's always interested me is that when the U.S. Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in the Gregg decision, they basically did it because, like you said, they were worried about the arbitrariness of it. And Georgia had enacted what was called a proportionality review, where they would make sure that every death sentence that was carried out was not out of proportion with prior death sentences. And that was seemed to convince the high court, or helped convince the high court, that it wouldn't be so arbitrary. So in every Georgia Supreme Court death penalty decision, they have at the very end what's called a proportionality review. And usually it's just a perfunctory list of other cases that had previously gotten the death penalty that were similar, apparently similar. You know, you have to go look at them, you have to go look them up, that were similar to the case that they were deciding. And I always thought that that was pretty inadequate, because you just cite a bunch of cases, you don't really delve into, you know, all these other cases that might have been similar that didn't get the death penalty. So I said, what I would like to do is do a proportionality review now of cases. And we, you know, we're trying to figure out how long a period to look at. And I know that in the McCleskey case that was decided in 1987, I believe, it was a racial discrimination challenge out of another Georgia death penalty case, that David Baldus, who's now deceased, he at the University of Iowa had done a proportionality review. He had looked at hundreds of murder cases at that time and tried to find out which cases received death and which didn't. And I said, I would like to do that myself. So we got about four reporters together, and we looked at 10 years worth of murder cases. They were all murder convictions in Georgia. There were 2,328, and we went to courthouses all over the state. Now, the crazy thing about Georgia is there are 159 counties. So we had to go to about 100, not every courthouse, but just about, and look through the court files. We copied records. We, you know, looked at police reports. We got medical examiner's reports. We did interviews, and we looked at all these cases, and we could decide which cases qualified for the death penalty. Those were the ones we really focused on, which qualified for the death penalty under Georgia law, and then which ones got it. And we found that it was so arbitrary still. It was some of the most heinous cases with the strongest evidence imaginable. They didn't even seek death for, whereas a drunken brawl where somebody gets killed gets the death penalty. So that was fascinating. It took about a year. It was pretty depressing reading all those cases too, I gotta say. You know, we read hundreds of cases where people were killed. I think we showed pretty well that it's not working the way it's supposed to. And I guess, as an aside, you know, we were looking through all these cases that got the death penalty, and we looked at this proportionality review. Like I said, it's like a string of 12 to 15 decisions. They would just tack it at the end of the ruling to say that it complies with the review. I can't remember if it was me or my editor or somebody, we noticed when we were looking through these cases that I said that case was reversed. You know, the case they cited. And then we started looking at some others, and we saw that they were citing cases that had been overturned before they did the proportionality review. So we thought, there were four of us, and I can't remember how many death penalty cases we had. We divided them all up, and we went, I think on a weekend, we read through every case. We knew we had a database of all the cases that had been overturned. And so we went against that database, and we came back, and we were just agog. We couldn't believe it. They were citing case after case had been overturned, In some cases, they were citing cases that had been overturned where the guy had been retried and acquitted. And they were using those cases to justify a proportional review. It was really, so they haven't done that. Since we had that story, the Georgia Supreme Court is not citing overturned cases anymore. But it kind of showed how the review was inadequate, to say the least. It's been disappointing in that regard.
Okay, another thing I wanted to discuss was a case that you talked about in the first season of Breakdown. It was the John Jerome White case, and it bears upon something we've touched upon undisclosed, and something that I think is maybe the biggest misconception that you see with regard to how the public views eyewitness testimony. And so could you tell us a bit about the John Jerome White case and what happened there?
A woman who lived in a small town south of Atlanta. She was an elderly woman. She had gone to sleep on her sofa, I believe, and was sound asleep when a man broke in. It was dark. He broke in the house, and it's awful. He raped her, and he hit her so hard on the side of the face, I think part of her face was partially paralyzed because of it. And you know, the police came, they took her to the police station, and they had some suspects, immediately had some suspects, and they had one in particular, and they had a couple of, I guess they got three other guys there at the jail to join this guy in a lineup and hoping that she would pick him out. And as it turned out, she did pick out the guy that they thought did it. He was tried and convicted and sentenced to decades in prison. As it turned out, the guy who raped her was in that lineup, but she didn't pick him. He just happened to be at the jail at the time. And so the guy who served decades in prison for that was later exonerated by DNA evidence. It's just an amazing story because we had the actual photo that shows the guy who was convicted standing next to the guy who actually did it. And it's funny, the picture, the guy's face, he looks pretty worried. The guy she did not pick. I don't think there's ever been a case like that before. It's just, it shows the fallibility of eyewitness testimony.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've heard of this case. It's what immediately triggered something in my head when I heard you mention it. It's not exactly the same factual context, but it's the case of Ronald Cotton. And actually, there was a 60 Minutes piece about it a few years ago. It was a case out of North Carolina, and it was the rape of Jennifer Thompson Canino, and she picked Ronald Cotton out of a lineup. And then years later, she was presented with Bobby Poole, who actually, based upon later DNA testing, was determined to be the person who committed the sexual assault. And she was 100% convinced it wasn't Bobby Poole, it was Ronald Cotton. And the 60 Minutes story goes through and in very rigorous detail explains how there are all these fallibilities with eyewitness identification, especially cross-racial identification, and eventually Thompson Canino and Cotton became friends. She wrote a book called Picking Cotton. They go around the country talking about these problems that exist with eyewitness identification testimony. And you know, as you note, I think that the John Jerome White case is another great example of that being an issue. I guess through all your reporting and the podcasting and everything, what else might surprise some listeners about issues that exist in the criminal justice system? Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just say, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I did see her come speak in Atlanta when they were trying to get a uniform bill through the legislature where they would have uniform practices on eyewitness identification throughout every police station in the state. And she was very powerful. What a story. What else would surprise in the criminal justice system? We've done a lot of work in looking at the mandatory minimum. Georgia has some of the most strict mandatory minimum sentences in the nation. We looked at armed robbery cases, and it's being applied unevenly. Many people are allowed to plead guilty to a lesser charge to avoid the mandatory minimum. And some of those cases are more heinous than the people who, you know, maybe didn't even have a real gun, and they get the mandatory minimum. So it's things like that that just continue, and that gives me a lot to write about.
We mentioned when we were emailing back and forth to set this up that you have listened to either some or all of Undisclosed, and I wonder, as someone who's been in the journalism game for so long, what's it like to hear the three of us as lawyers, law professors without the journalistic background, podcasting about some of these issues that you've been writing about for a mass audience for all these years.
Well, it's almost like you got a little bit of journalism going on because you're reporting about what's going on. I've learned so much from Undisclosed. I mean, just the case law that you cite often is fascinating to me. I think I said Addendum 8. I listened to that again just over the weekend. You know, you hear one of those cases, I can't remember all the, I'm bad on names, but you went through case after case, and I heard one case and I would think, God, that's a book, you know, that's, and then there's another one, and then there's another one, and then there's another one. So when you hear things like that, and then you look at the case of Adnan's case and see all these other things that are going wrong, I think it just shows how, you know, this criminal justice system we have is fantastic in so many ways, but it's not infallible. And, I think y'all have done a great job showing that through Adnan's case, but also all these other cases you cite. I'm very impressed by it. I've learned a lot.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's. I'm glad to hear that. I wonder, the last question then would just be, how many episodes do you expect to do for this second season? Is the whole season in the can? Are you still sorting things out? And then do you think that this is going to be the end of the road, or do you anticipate that this is something you're enjoying and it's going to proceed to season 3, 4, or 5 down the road?
Well, we have... The trial starts on the 11th. We have 4 episodes that are going to come out. One episode will come out the day after the first day of jury selection, and then another episode will come out the following Tuesday. Our plan is for me and Christian Boone, who is reporting the case for the newspaper, we will sit down and have periodic discussions about what's happened and what we expect to come. And I listened to Finish Line, which was, I thought, was very well done podcast by a reporter from the Boston Globe and the Boston public TV station up there about the bombing trial of Tsarnaev. And they did it almost every day. We're not going to do it every day. I think we'll try to do it once a week. And once the trial is over, we'll have a concluding episode as well. That's the plan. As to whether we can continue season 3, season 4, one of the joys about this with me is that I get to work with one of my best friends, Richard Hallex, who's my editor. And he happened to work for my dad when my dad worked at the paper. He's been around for a good bit, and he's the best editor imaginable, and we just have so much fun putting these together. So long as he's around, I'll be, and if I'm around, we'd love to do more seasons. Got to find some good cases. That's what y'all are looking for right now, some good cases, right?
Right. We're gearing up for our own second season now. So, well, anyway, Bill, I really appreciate you joining me here today. And again, for those of you who want to listen, it is Breakdown by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Season 1 is available many places, including iTunes. And as we noted, season 2 is currently underway. So thanks once again, Bill.
Thank you.
First, say that if you haven't heard Bill's podcast, it is a must listen. The work of investigative journalists like Rankin has proven invaluable to exposing the stories of countless wrongful convictions and the systemic failures that allow them to take place. These things aren't just a matter of luck, as I've said before. They're a matter of every part of the system failing, and by now you should realize it happens much more commonly than you would ever have believed. But of course, the system also gets it right much of the time. At least, it gets the right person for the crime. But even then, there's plenty of room for injustice. Join us next week when we look at the stories of youth offenders and the devastating impact of unconscionable sentencing of children caught up in crime. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoie. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer. And you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.